Welcome to the Ungagged Miners Strike 40th Anniversary Special. I'm introducing you today to a friend of mine, Richie Venton. Richie grew up in Northern Ireland before emigrating to Liverpool and then Scotland. A trade unionist and socialist with decades of dedicated experience, he's widely respected for building support for workers and communities in struggle. Richie was the central organiser of the Merseyside Socialists, who led a victorious mass movement against Thatcher's government in the 1980s, which won big reforms for the people of Liverpool. He was expelled from the Labour Party by Neil Kinnock's leadership for being an effective socialist. Richie was a founder organisation of the Scottish Socialist Party in 1998, and he is the SSP's National Workplace Organiser and West of Scotland Regional Organiser, and recently has been on the National EC of the Retail Trade Union USDA. Richie is the author of lots of great pamphlets and books, in particular Break the Chains and 1917 Walls Come Tumbling Down, and he's a regular writer in the Scottish Socialist Voice.
40 years ago this week, in March 1984, tens of thousands of miners across England, Scotland and Wales walked out on strike. It was a battle to save their jobs against pit closures, to save their communities, and indeed to save a whole way of life. It turned into a one-year struggle, and it turned into a battle between 150,000 striking miners, the women of the pit villages, and their allies in the wider working class on the one side, and all the forces of the old capitalist state on the other. It was the biggest showdown between the two fundamental classes in society in British history, certainly since the general strike of 1926. It came about as a result of conscious planning and provocation by the Tory government of Maggie Thatcher. Because if you do a quick sketch background, in the period from the Second World War up until the mid-1970s, the rich could afford crumbs from their table to the working class. They carried out a number of reforms, frankly, to prevent revolution from above in the period immediately after the Second War. But that came to a grinding halt in the mid-1970s, exacerbated by the oil crisis and the leap in oil prices, for example, in 1973. And therefore, the rulers of Britain began to claw back the reforms and the gains that workers had achieved in the previous 30 years. And that applied certainly to the mining industry. The mining industry had been one of the backbones of the growth of British capitalist power and wealth and the growth of the empire. But they had no mercy when it came to crushing the miners who had produced that wealth. In 1972 and again in 1974, the miners defeated the previous Tory government of Ted Heath through strike action. In 1974, February, Heath went to the country in a general election at the height of the miners' strike and gave people the choice who rules the country, the unions or the government. And he got his answer by being evicted by the people of Britain and the return of a Labour government. And from that period on, the Tories and the ruling class more widely plotted revenge against the miners. Now, the miners only constituted 2% of the organised trade union movement, but they were seen as the vanguard, the leading force of the working class, and the Tories were out to crush them. In the 1977 infamous Ridley Plan of Nicholas Ridley, Thatcher's right-hand man and right-wing collaborator, in that plan, they plotted a course for class war against one section of workers against after another, divide and conquer, and planned how to smash the miners amongst others. For example, in 1983, prior to the miners' strike, they took on print workers in Warrington, the Stockport Messenger. The Shah of Warrington, as he became known, Eddie Shah, was out to crush the print union, and I witnessed firsthand the methods of the police there, where they had snatch squads, riot police, and police on horseback against the mass pickets outside the Shah's print shop. So they did all that. They prepared in other ways as well. for a showdown with the miners. We beefed up the police. Massive pay increases, contrary to the usual habit before and since then of pay cuts for the police. They bribed them and bought their loyalty with big increases in their pay. They organised the National Police Reporting Centre at the behest of the government, and the memoirs of police chiefs have subsequently confirmed that it was the Tories that insisted on that. It wasn't something that the police chiefs themselves requested, which meant that the police were controlled nationally from Scotland Yard in order to deploy them according to the wishes of the government. They also prepared inside the Secret Services the memoirs of people like Stella Remington, who went on to become the head of MI5, confirmed that there was close collaboration between her and Maggie Thatcher and GCHQ and other places to prepare against the miners' strike and during the miners' strike. So they did all of that. They stockpiled coal. There was some like 6 months' supply initially during the miners' strike. They increased imports of coal. They spent £10 billion, the government, £40 billion in today's money, to introduce dual oil and coal-fired power stations and to switch to nuclear power, even though that was more expensive at the time than coal, in order to try and undermine any strike by the miners. And then, having prepared, they provoked the strike. They provoked it by announcing the closure of the Cortonwood pit in South Yorkshire on the 1st of March 1984, despite the fact they previously pledged that pit had another 5 years' life in it as a minimum. Now, the miners walked out, and within a couple of days, half the Yorkshire coalfield were on strike. Kent walked out. A couple of days later, Scotland walked out, and then in turn, South Wales. And within a week, 134 pits out of 174 were on strike. Within 2 weeks, the National Coal Board had to admit that there was only 11 mines that were working normally. That was the scale of the response of the miners, the basic solidarity against the provocation of that pit closure, because they knew it was only the start of it, that they were going to have wholesale pit closures, as Arthur Scargill had warned. Now, immediately, there was massive support from other sections of the working class. As time went on, that was reflected in the collections for hardship, for money, for food and so on, outside supermarkets, at places of worship, on the streets. In fact, overall, during the course of the year, it was estimated that £60 million was collected for the miners from the wider working class nationally and internationally. That's £240 million in today's money, a phenomenal indication of the support that they gained. And the other thing was that other sections of workers began to realise that they were in the same boat, and the potential was there for more generalised action, particularly at certain junctures during the course of the year. I'll itemise two or three examples. In July of 1984, the dockers came out on strike, and that was a time when the Tories were in a state of panic, because the prospects were that the dockers on strike, the miners on strike, and the threat of a strike by railway workers actually at the same time could have turned into a general strike. And some of us, you know, socialists at the time, including myself, were agitating for, as a minimum, a 24-hour general strike at that time. And the Tories were preparing, on the other hand, for that showdown, because, for example, they were openly discussing the need to declare a state of emergency. It's since been confirmed in declassified documents of the government that they were actually prepared not just for a state of emergency, but for the use of the troops to move coal and food at that time. But the dockers' leadership, without going into detail, ended up calling off the strike for a kind of a half-baked settlement. And then again, something similar was repeated by a dock strike in August-September period. And probably the biggest threat to the Tories was in the period of October, because the pit deputies or pit supervisors, who were in charge of, amongst other things, the maintenance of the pits, had been working, at least some of them, but they organised a strike ballot, which came out with an 83% majority for action. And the strike was meant to start on the 25th of October. And that was when Thatcher, in her memoirs, admits that the government was on the brink of collapse. She was considering resigning as Prime Minister. The chairman of the Central Electricity Generating Board admitted that there was only 6 weeks' supply of coal remaining. And as he put it, the Scargill could win by at least Christmas. They were in a state of desperate panic at the prospect of all pits shutting down, which is what would have happened if the pit deputies had gone on strike on the 25th of October. And that would have brought it to a head, and the government probably would have had to cave in to the demands of the miners over pit closures. But Thatcher, whilst preparing for a state of emergency again, and also actually since it's been confirmed, preparing for use of the troops openly, the army openly, instead what took place is that the right-wing leadership of the Pit Deputies Union, NACODs as it was called, capitulated to a shoddy deal that was a completely meaningless promise of an amendment to the pit closure reviews process, which amounted to nothing and came to nothing later on when the pits were shut. But they climbed down and cancelled the strike on the 24th, the day before the strike was meant to begin. And it's no accident that on the next day, the 25th, when the strike had been cancelled the night before, Thatcher moved in and used the High Courts to seize all the funds of the National NUM, the National Miners Union. That's no accident of timing. They were on the brink of collapse, and then they moved in with vicious brutality to try and smash the miners once and for all by seizing their funds. And they also used the Secret Services in that process. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's a fact that Roger Windsor, who was the chief executive of the National Union of Mine Workers, was a shadowy character who'd previously worked for the Public Service International, public sector unions, who are well known to be actually funded by the CIA in terms of their top leadership internationally. But then he was either an open agent, an actual agent, I should say, of MI5, or he was an unwitting collaborator with him. Because he, for example, the very same time went to Libya to get money. Arthur Scargill and Peter Heathfield, the General Secretary of the Union, understood that he was going to collect money from the Libyan trade union movement. That was what he told them. But when he got there, he insisted on having an audience with Colonel Gaddafi, not just Libyan trade unions, in other words. He insisted on having a meeting with Colonel Gaddafi, who was the international bête noire of the time. He was the international hate figure of the governments of places like Britain and America. And also, he was associated in Britain in the minds of many of the public with the fact that a police officer, Yvonne Fletcher, had been shot, killed outside the Libyan embassy during the course of 1984. So that was the worst possible association for the miners. But what Roger Windsor did was to have that audience with Gaddafi and insist that it was televised, and greeted Gaddafi with the traditional Arab greeting of a kiss on both cheeks. And that then was turned into a huge weapon against the miners in the right-wing press the next period. And it was used to isolate the miners in the minds of the public. And that was just a reminder of the methods that were used against the NUM throughout that strike. Because what I want to try to quickly address is the question, why did they not win? Why were they defeated eventually and go back to work in early March 1984 without any settlement agreement, without any promise to reinstate the 700 miners who'd been sacked from their jobs, victimised and sacked during the strike? Why did that happen? It wasn't for the lack of will on the part of miners. It wasn't for the lack of will on the part of the miners' wives and the women of the pit villages and so on. It wasn't for the lack of will of tens of thousands and millions, in fact, of working class people during that the great miner strike of 1984-5. Because solidarity in the working class reached fever pitch. It was a phenomenon to live through. The miners showed untold courage and tenacity. But they suffered a couple of things. First of all, they suffered all the weight of the British state being thrown against them. The state took the form, ultimately, of armed bodies of men, to use the term of Frederick Engels. And that was shown openly to millions of people in practice. At least 20,000 police officers were mobilised against picket lines for mass assemblies and to blockade roads and to prevent people getting to reach miners who were still working to persuade them to come out on strike. For example, as soon as the young Yorkshire miners went on strike at the announcement of the Cortonwood closure, they crossed the border into Nottinghamshire and initially had some success in convincing Nottingham miners as they went to work by talking to them to come out on strike. In fact, at a peak, 40 to 50% of miners in Nottinghamshire were actually out on strike. But then that was turned into a position where only about 20% in Nottinghamshire, the second biggest coalfield after Yorkshire, took strike action. And the reason for that, first and foremost, was that the police were used to blockade roads. It was turned into a mini police state that prevented people getting to Nottingham. The chief constable of the area subsequently admitted that in the first 6 months, 165,000 people who were presumed to be pickets were prevented from getting into Nottinghamshire to discuss with working miners to get them to come out on strike. It was, we at the time, as socialists, compared it to the past laws in apartheid South Africa, where it prevented people moving from one place to another. At another stage of that strike, the police were actually used to turn pit villages into mini police states, where they imposed curfews on miners. And striking miners, in particular, were prevented from moving from one village to another, even with their own, in their own area. They couldn't go to drink in the pubs they usually went to, because it was seen as interfering with the lives of working miners who were scabbing on them. That was the depths to which the state resorted, as well as phone tapping, prevention of movement by miners, the road blockades that I've already mentioned. And of course, it involved also regular police violence against strikers, culminating on the 18th of June in the Battle of Orgreave in South Yorkshire, where 10,000 pickets arrived and they were bemused at the ease with which they had passage to reach the picket, it was called, because they didn't face the usual roadblocks from the police. They were amazed when the police were ushering them towards the gathering point as if they were, you know, type tourist guides or wedding ushers. They're friendly approached by the police to show them where to park. But they soon discovered what was happening, because the 10,000 demonstrators and pickets suddenly discovered they were surrounded by 4,000 to 5,000 police officers, including police officers with riot gear, in military formation, on horseback, who proceeded to wade in, charge down the crowds with horses, smash people's heads in with truncheons, assault them, arrested 95 miners, charged them with things like riot, which could have been a prolonged prison sentence, cases that collapsed subsequently in court because the police were proven to have fabricated the evidence. So it was, as the Liberty organisation described it, there was a riot, but it was a police riot. That was Orgreave, 18th of June, 1984. And that was only one high-profile example of the violence meted out to miners and pickets and their supporters, where there was mass arrests. 11,500 were arrested. Some like 5,500 faced charges in court. Well over 100 miners were jailed. over 700 were sacked. It was the brute force of the state unleashed against workers who were trying to save their communities from degradation and long-term deprivation, as subsequently happened in the ex-mining areas. So that was the major reason the miners were defeated. But it wasn't even that, because they were resilient still and stayed out for a year. The biggest cause of defeat was the treachery of the right wing of the trade union movement and of the leadership of the Labour Party under Neil Kinnock. I heard Neil Kinnock on the radio the other day still spouting his vacuous garbage that the reason that the miners were defeated was that Arthur Scargill did not organise a national ballot. Now, on the issue of the national ballot, a very quick word. I think when miners walked out on strike in early March and one coalfield after another came out, it was absolutely right to try and build that strike and was absolutely wrong to respond to the demand that the right wing of the NUM was calling for, which was to suspend those strikes, to tell the workers to go back to work whilst a ballot was conducted. That would have been utter misleadership. It would have been strike-breaking, frankly, to do that at that stage. However, once 80% of the miners were out on strike, as took place over the first couple of weeks, once most of the coal fields were out, but a minority were out in Nottinghamshire, for example, then it would have been right, and we said so at the time, it would have been a good tactic to organise a strike ballot, not to send them back to work, but to keep the 80% out on strike whilst conducting that ballot, because it would have been won overwhelmingly. Opinion polls amongst miners conducted in mid-April proved that to be the case, for instance. And if that had been done, it would have disarmed the enemy. The enemy in the form of the media, of Maggie Thatcher, who suddenly discovered democracy and started preaching nonsense about how Scargill was keeping people out on strike against their will. It would have disarmed the right wing of the trade union movement and disarmed people like Kinnock, who treacherously denounced Scargill for not having a ballot. It would have cut across all that, and I actually think it would have definitely won over the vast majority of the Nottinghamshire miners to come out on strike, because they would have obeyed the decision of a national ballot. And many, many thousands of miners at that time, around late March, April, believed that that should have been done, and that would have overcome a complication. But I have to stress, the lack of a ballot at the appropriate moment is not the reason that they lost. It was a complication, but wasn't the reason they lost. They could have won several times over, despite that complication, as I've mentioned, in terms of the government being on the brink of collapse and defeat several times subsequently. The real reason was the treachery of right-wing union leaders and Neil Kinnock. To just quote a couple of examples to illustrate the general. The leaders of the power engineering workers, people like John Lyons, the leaders of the Steelworkers Union, ISTC, like Bill Soares, who then later became Sir Bill Soares, were treacherous openly, where they said that their members should cross picket lines. Their members should cross the picket lines of the miners. Leaders even of the steelworkers in places like Ravenscraig, like Tommy Brennan, openly stated he would accept scab coal and iron ore from any source when the miners were fighting for their lives. Now, the miners' union had agreed to supply coke, coal, to the furnaces of the steelworks to prevent them collapsing. In other words, a care and maintenance regime. But what happened was that far more than that type of supply was brought through by scab lorries, by Yule and Dodds and other companies like that, who had been arranged secret deals by the Tory government in preparation for the miners' strike, actually, hiring cowboys and hiring previously unemployed lorry drivers to go through the picket lines. So when those right-wing union leaders allowed supplies to come in to sustain and actually increase steel production, that was going against entirely the agreement that had been reached with area officials of the NUM, who had agreed to supply enough coke to allow the steel furnaces from going into collapse to maintain them, in other words, for the duration of the strike. What they should have been doing instead was bringing their own workers in on strike with them, because we knew the steel workers were facing the chop if the miners were defeated. And that, of course, is what took place later on. So it was the right-wing failure and people like Kinnock denouncing the pickets, where he refused to go to a single strikers' rally until November, even though he was regularly asked to. And when he did go, he used that platform in Stoke to denounce picket line violence. Never a word about the violence of the police, but to denounce alleged violence from the strikers. So Kinnock played his part in defeating the miners. And then in the aftermath of his defeat, of course, it assisted the move to the right by the Labour Party. It assisted the capitalists in their ideological warfare. It assisted the Tory government, emboldened by the defeat of the miners in 85, in carrying out even further, more vicious anti-union laws against the entire working class. It helped Thatcher and Company to deindustrialise the country, to turn previously industrial areas into deserts and call it progress, to turn them into areas of drug addiction and mass deprivation and call it progress. It allowed the Labour Party leadership to go even more right-wing and gradually abandon the idea of socialism, let alone even just basic solidarity. So that's the real reason for the defeat, the utter abject failure of the leaderships of the TUC, of the right-wing trade unions, of Kinnock's leadership of Labour, to come to the assistance of the miners in their hour of need. Because what was plain from day one is that there was so much at stake that the miners on their own were not adequate when it came to defeating the Tories. The Tories had prepared for years before. They're out to smash and break the backs of the mining union in order to break the backs of the wider working class. And that therefore required a more generalised response. And it would have been there if the union leaders had the confidence to call on their own membership to come to the side of the miners and come out with them, for example, in the form of general strike action, which could have occurred on many occasions during that year. It was a bitter struggle. It was one which transformed the outlook of millions. And what I should have mentioned earlier, it particularly transformed the outlook of women. Women in the pit villages responded to the starvation tactics of Thatcher by organising soup kitchens, free community cafes, food parcel centres and so on, but then went beyond that to organise their own distinct women's picket lines and to tour the country and other countries, becoming the most eloquent of speakers on behalf of the struggle of the mining communities. They were transformed in their outlook, and most of them had never been in a job, incidentally, because the tradition in those communities tended to be that the miners went to work, the women stayed at home and minded the family. And the men themselves quite often had quite a conservative, even backward attitude towards women, but many of them, most of them, were transformed in their outlook towards women during that year of class struggle, because they discovered that the women were the best class fighters once they took action. It also transformed the outlook of young people. School students, for example, came out on school student strikes a couple of weeks after the miners had been defeated in March 85. For example, in Liverpool, where I was, 20,000 came out on strike. We were in the leadership of them, our young members, and 10,000 of them marched through the city centre in an utterly chaotic but highly charged, energetic demonstration. They were protesting against the threat of conscription into compulsory youth training schemes, slave labour schemes, by the Tory government of the time. It charged society with a class understanding. It brought home a few fundamental things. That class is the primary definition of the nature of society, and that working class solidarity is the primary weapon in our own defence, and that that requires in turn a socialist alternative to bring about a society where the terrible sufferings that the mining community subsequently suffered and the wider work class did after that defeat in 85. To end that, you need socialism. And the struggle of the miners were an inspiration. The solidarity was an inspiration. Well, the socialist leadership was required in the wider trade union movement. and in the political movement, and it was not there on a mass scale at the time. That was the real reason they lost, and that's the biggest lesson coming out of those events 40 years later.